House Committee on Revenue for Monday, I mean, I'm sorry, for Thursday, May 21st, 2015 will come to order. Colleagues, no matter what I may say later on in the meeting, our next meeting is Tuesday. So just so we all know. We'll open a work session on Senate Bill 26. Who's on that one? Good. Mazin?
Good afternoon, Chair, members of the committee. It is Tuesday.
Thursday, too.
Thursday.
Sorry.
Groundhog Day.
Okay. Senate Bill 26, just to refresh your memory about it, we looked at this bill. It's remember the bill itself is a simple few lines deleting a sunset date, and the sunset date is primarily the one that allows allows the counties receiving federal forest money, and the language in law specifies seven of these counties to be able to use the road segment of those federal amounts to their policing, road policing in those seven counties. And of course, just to be specific about what these allowances are within the law, there are two distinct ways that the counties could use it. One, that they could transfer amounts from those transportation funds to the sheriff and policing public safety accounts, and they could use those funds in a loan format that they pay back on the budget and pay back in about 3 years. Now, the second version is open for the seven counties, but also is open for the counties that receive federal funds without being named as one of the seven. In other words, there is about 33 counties in Oregon that do receive those federal funds, and out of those 33, the seven could do with it what they want in the transfer. The other ones, minus those sevens, could only use it in a loan type of format. Now, I've put on all this a sheet of information that came from the different counties to show the ones that used some of these funds and how they used it and the amounts that they used it. I think there was few questions that you had last time about these different uses, and those would hopefully have some of the answers that you were looking for. It seems the other option, where you have the counties able to borrow the money and budget it and pay it in 3 years, is very seldomly used, seldom to none almost. But the other ones are here. And that's the bill, Mr. Chair.
Okay. Colleagues, what's your pleasure? I can tell you my preference is that we allow the counties that want to do it the continued flexibility of using the road funds. Representative Vega Peterson, do you have a motion for us?
Yes. Chair, I move Senate Bill 26 to the floor with a due pass recommendation.
Thank you. Representative Vega Peterson moves Senate Bill 26 to the floor with a due pass recommendation. Is there a discussion? Yes, Representative Whitsitt.
I will be a no on it. My commissioners are not in favor of it. So.
Okay. Is the county you're referring to in the list?
Yep.
It is. And in fiscal year 15-16, they show the $850,000 grant that they allocated to themselves.
Yeah, I just what we have from Commissioner Kelly Minty Morris is on behalf of the citizens, not on behalf of the county.
Ah.
And so I'm just going to be a no on.
Is it possible the commissioners are divided on this issue?
Yes, it is.
Okay. All right. Just checking. Other discussion? I think we better call the roll.
Representative Davis?
Aye.
Representative Johnson?
Aye.
Representative Leininger?
Aye.
Representative Reed?
Aye.
Representative Smith Warner?
Aye.
Representative Whitson?
No.
Vice Chair Megan Peterson?
Aye.
Chair Barnhart?
Aye. Representative Benz is excused. Motion having received the required majority is declared adopted. Anyone have a burning desire to carry this bill? If not, I will. And with that, we'll close the work session on Senate Bill 26. Colleagues, we're going to carry over House Bill 3125 to Tuesday. There's some significant amendments that are yet to be drafted on that bill, and I'm not sure exactly where we are on it. And of course, you were all here for the conversation this morning in the Joint Tax Credit Committees, in which I indicated the possibility that that bill could end up being worked there as part of the omnibus bill, just simply because of timing. It's that's all. House Bill 2961, we're taking that off the calendar for the time being. That's what we need to do, isn't it, Representative Reed?
Yes.
Yeah. Take that off the calendar for the time being, and subject, of course, to be rescheduled later if appropriate. We'll open a work session on House Bill 2099 for the purpose of additional conversation. If my understanding, we have another amendment to discuss. Paul will tell us.
Mr. Chair, members of the committee, we do not have another amendment. We just have the dash six, which you discussed yesterday. But we do have a little bit of additional information that, based on the discussion you had, you talked about the need for some examples.
Thank you, Paul.
On how that might work. And I have a hard copy for those of you who, like me, who have a hard time seeing the smaller numbers on the big screen.
And is it posted to OLIS?
It is posted. It's up here on OLIS.
Okay.
So the format we have, you recall, we looked at this, I believe, back in March when we looked at how overall sales in a listed jurisdiction would affect the apportionment coming back to Oregon. So what I did was just kind of add an additional block in here to look at the impact of having income reported in a listed jurisdiction that is not attributable to transactions or activity of U.S. affiliates. So that's the language in your dash six amendment. So, of course, the idea is if it's not income that originates from the U.S., then it's not, it can be subtracted from that total. So the first example there is the same we looked at before. It's a consolidated return A, as we're calling it. And it's classified, my label for it is a pure tax haven. There's no sales in that jurisdiction, and it's a pure U.S. tax haven because there's not any income in that reported there that is not attributable to transactions or activity of U.S. affiliates. So just have $1,000 or $1 billion here, if it's in millions, of income reported in that jurisdiction. That gets, using Oregon's sales share, which is assumed to be 5%, you have $300 million apportioned back to Oregon, apply the Oregon tax rates, and you get, and the effect of that listed jurisdiction is a $3.8 million increase on the tax bill of this corporation. So their taxes went from $19 million to $22.8 million, or an increase of $3.8 million. So that's the purest case. The consolidated return B is
And yes, please, Representative Davis.
My apologies, Paul.
And this is the case we were dealing with when we were thinking about this in 13, isn't it? Essentially.
Yes, this is the Grand Cayman Islands kind of situation.
Right, Representative Davis.
Paul, thank you, Chair. Could you, what is the connection or lack of connection between the Water's Edge net income of $5 million and the net income reported in listed jurisdiction? I'm just trying to Water's Edge, we're talking about inside, right?
Yes.
Inside the U.S.
Right. This would be a number that would be on the federal consolidated return.
So
these are U.S. national income at the Water's Edge.
Okay.
So that's under, before 2460 passed in 13, this would be the total of your taxes. You'd be paying $19 million on taxes before credits based on that $5 billion Water's Edge income, of which 5% came back to Oregon, or $250 million apportioned back to Oregon.
Got it.
And then, so now what happened with the 2013 legislation, if this is a listed jurisdiction, now this corporation has to look to see if they have a subsidiary that's part of their unitary group that is located in one of these listed jurisdictions that has reportable income there. In this example, they've got $1 billion in income reported there. They have no sales there, so your sales share is still 5%. So you're just adding to income. You're adding to the amount that you're apportioning back to Oregon without having any dilution from sales in that jurisdiction.
Thank you.
So that's why I think of it as a pure tax haven example. And then the so there you've got your increase in Oregon tax resulting from that, adding that $1 billion back in terms of that net income, and then apportioning it back to Oregon.
Thank you.
Which gives you $300 million to apportion back to Oregon. Now, consolidated return B tries to address the issue that we talked about with the Dash 6 amendments, and that is where you have income not attributable to transactions or activity of U.S. affiliates.
I'm sorry.
Yes, please. Yeah. No, I think it's important that we understand what these items mean, and so go ahead, please.
Thank you. Remind me how we got to the income apportioned to Oregon of $300 million. What's the multiple? Because 0.05 times 1,000 is not 300.
The income apportioned to Oregon would include net income from Water's Edge,
uh-huh,
plus the net income from the listed jurisdiction.
Got it. So the 250 plus 50.
Right.
Mm-hmm. Thank you.
No, actually, it's the 1 billion plus, it's 6 billion that comes back to Oregon. So you're taking 5% instead of 5% of income from Water's Edge, you're taking 5% of the income from Water's Edge plus the listed jurisdiction.
The 300 includes the 250.
Yes. Yes. That's
your the confusing part.
Yeah, it's 250 plus 50 from
the. Yeah. The
0.05. 5% of 6 billion.
Yes.
Times 6 billion.
Right.
Thank you.
5% of 6 billion.
Okay. Great.
So that's just an addition that's reported on the return. Now, you get to the issue around the portion that comes from other sources, not attributable to U.S. activity. So if we don't have any sales, so you would tend to see this as primarily a more of a pure tax haven transaction here. The net income reported is the same, but in this case, a half of that net income that's reported is not attributable to these U.S. activity. Mm-hmm. So therefore, instead of adding you will still add on your return under the Dash 6, you'll add the $1 billion, but then you'll have a subtraction, or what the language in the bill is, an elimination of $500 million. So therefore, instead of adding $1 billion to your income, you'll be adding $500 and then apportioning that back to Oregon. And you can see now your income apportioned back to Oregon, instead of being $300 million as it is in the case consolidated return A, it's $275 million. That's the number in blue there. So now your taxes, instead of being 22.8 or 20.9, which is still 1.9 million higher than the pre-2460 law without the listed jurisdictions, but it is less than the case where all of your activity, all of the income in that tax jurisdiction comes from the U.S.
So Paul, if I may, Mr. Chair.
Yes, please. Yeah.
The 500 that's are we using added back or eliminated?
This is eliminated.
This is the eliminated phrase.
So, yes. So you still have the billion in income. You're still reporting that on your return. But then now you've got this portion of it that you can attribute to these U.S. that you cannot attribute to U.S. activity of U.S. affiliates.
So purely outside the water's edge entities within the unitary group? Is that the idea?
Well, these are, you know, any of these are beyond the water's edge. What we're saying is we're not picking them up with the water's edge. But the theory behind including these is that they should be included in the water's edge. They reflect the activity of U.S. affiliates, but they're just being reported for tax purposes in another location. So in the case of the pure tax haven, then we just add the full amount. In this case, we're saying, okay, we're going to add the full amount, but we recognize that a portion of this income that's reported does not originate from U.S. activity. It cannot be associated with U.S. activity. It could be activity in Germany or some other country that's being shifted to the listed jurisdiction, but it does not have it. It's not based on U.S. activity. So, and we suspect that happens quite a bit. I mean, it stands to reason that if major corporations are going to be shifting profits, which we know they do, it may well be that the original source of that income is non-U.S., because we're talking about very large corporations. So the policy is to try to pull those out of this calculation so that we're not adding in income that really should be attributed to another country. We just the goal is to try to get a more accurate reflection of the economic activity in the U.S., that being the appropriate base, the base that we're trying to, theoretically, is what we're trying to tax here. So this is an adjustment on the previous legislation that passed to account for that situation.
Mr. Chair, my quizzical looks are trying to distinguish between the fact that we are talking in every instance here about outside the water's edge activity, but then we seem to be saying if it's really, really, really outside the water's edge, then we're going to eliminate it. So what's the difference between outside and really outside?
Let me make the attempt.
Yeah.
This was an issue that was confusing to me at first. What these companies do now with their holding company subsidiaries is they artificially transfer income that was earned in the United States to a tax haven country where they have this subsidiary corporation, using mechanisms like the ownership of trademarks and copyrights and other intellectual property, and therefore and the royalties that are charged on them. But in one sense, these are phony transactions usable only to avoid paying taxes, because somehow or another we turn U.S. profits into profits made in the Grand Cayman Islands instead. So what we've done, what we did in 13, was we said, no, if it was earned in the United States and you're using this kind of a mechanism, we're going to treat it as U.S. income, even though you have used these tax-related only transactions to pretend that the income was not made in the United States. Now, so this is within the water's edge income that through a maneuver allowed by the Internal Revenue Code, but not by Oregon, this income has been transmogrified into income in the Grand Cayman Islands, where there, in fact, is no business activity going on. That's case one. Case two, or B, is one where the same thing is happening, except this corporation also does business in other places in the world, and some of those profits are made in those other places. But they're also using the same kind of transaction to avoid paying taxes in those other jurisdictions, and sending that money through this guise to the Grand Cayman Islands, for example. That money, because it came from somewhere else, is not U.S. income, and we shouldn't tax it. And that's B. Am I close?
Yes, that's exactly right. I mean, you recall from what the OECD publications we've looked at, they talked about BEPS, which is base erosion and profit shifting. What we're trying to get at through this mechanism is the profit shifting. And so the goal is to get profit shifting that was shifted from the U.S. water's edge to another location that is not reported on the federal return. It's reported in another location, but more appropriately should be to reflect economic activity reported in the Water's Edge. So it's an adjustment to the Water's Edge federal return. So, but we also recognize because it's profit shifting, it could well be shifted from some other location, some non-U.S. location. And that's what we're trying to pull out with this language.
So what B does, what we're doing with this piece, is that it actually more accurately reflects income earned in the United States, a portion of which, because of the sales proportion, is attributable to Oregon.
If I may.
Please, yeah.
So a few questions. Both within the United States and for entities outside, let's take the Netherlands example. They do have a tax rate. Of course, the...
Now, I think we're moving to C, aren't we, Paul?
Well, this, the C example has sales there, where you have not just... not just a pure tax haven with a post office box, but rather you have the actual economic activity there and sales there. And then that would, as we talked about earlier, if that's the case, then that does affect the proportion that comes back to Oregon because it affects the apportionment formula.
But you wanted, you had a different question.
Yeah, it's because it seems to me A, B, or C could be applicable if we do add the Netherlands or Switzerland or some of these other jurisdictions to the list.
Sure.
So how, in under the B or C instance, how do we deal with the Netherlands or any other of these listed jurisdictions or ones that could be listed that do have a tax rate? So they do apply some rate of tax to the income that we're talking about. That's question one, because are we double counting in that respect? And then B, for other states that have tax haven legislation, Montana, and then I believe there's a few other states, Delaware now has a factor-based statute as opposed to a listed jurisdiction statute. Are we double counting within those jurisdictions as well? So you'd be, they'd be counted in Oregon, the Netherlands, Montana, and Delaware.
Well, I think the idea on this is to, in terms of the taxation, you're trying to find and determine the apportionable amount that comes back to Oregon.
Yes.
So what you're saying is this income should be apportioned back to Oregon. So, for example, we don't in terms of our taxation, we don't have a subtraction for federal taxes, for U.S. taxes.
Mm-hmm.
So we just take our percentage and apply that to that net income.
So the company is still ahead if the tax in the Netherlands is lower than the Internal Revenue Code taxation, which they don't pay. They're still ahead because they don't owe the IRS. And if the tax rate in the Netherlands is lower than the tax rate that the IRS would otherwise impose on U.S. income, they're still ahead gross taxes.
Sorry. Follow-up. But I'm still concerned about the double counting, and they may still be ahead whether or not we like the rate in the Netherlands. Mm-hmm. That would be applied, and then we're pulling all of the income from the Netherlands also into artificially into Oregon by listing it and applying a rate in Oregon as well. Or am I misunderstanding?
I would change the language and say that we are discounting the artificial holding company and applying the accurate income in the United States, a portion of which is apportioned to Oregon. So we're removing the artificiality, not adding to it.
Artificial or not, we're adding a rate.
on this topic?
Yes.
On this topic?
Yes.
Yeah, well, what's it was ahead, so okay. Let's go to her
so
first.
So we talked about profits being shifted from one country to another country. How do we know if they've been shifted multiple times? How are you able to unravel if somebody really wants to do this? Then you just, it seems to me, would shift it through a bunch of different countries. So it's...
You saw my floor letter today, didn't you?
No. Actually, I didn't. I'm sorry, Phil.
Because it was on exactly that topic. Paul, you want to deal with that one? That's a great question.
Well, Mr. Chair, Representative Whitsitt, the idea behind designating these jurisdictions is that these are the jurisdictions where the criteria we've used, and the -6 puts that criteria explicitly into statute, using that criteria, these are the jurisdictions where we think that this will occur, where the profit shifting targets will occur. So the idea is to identify those and then to count them in the total base before we apportion that back to Oregon. So it always comes back to an apportionment back to Oregon. We're trying to get some percentage of that based on what we think is a more accurate measure of this corporation's U.S. economic activity. So if, for example, that Oregon were to list these jurisdictions and then there's some change in behavior to avoid being on this list, there's another country that's not on the list, we suspect there would be very little of that. Oregon is not a major player in the international tax environment. We don't think there would be much behavioral response to it. But certainly in terms of the overall mechanism, the way we see the world economy operating, there is a lot of this profit shifting going on. It's very sophisticated. So, and it's an evolving thing. And I think we're starting to see, I know we're starting to see a lot more reaction on the part of national governments, particularly the EU countries, who are responding to this and trying to find ways to reduce it. So it is an issue and a behavioral response we would expect in a kind of an iterative process to try to get a truer measure of where profits actually are generated.
Could I follow up?
Yeah, please, yeah.
So sort of related, but say you have a company in Oregon, you're working out of Oregon, but you incorporate in Delaware, for example. So how do you handle that if then that incorporated company is still doing the bulk of their work in Oregon, but it's Delaware, and then Delaware allows, I assume, some of these greater tax havens than Oregon would? Are you following me at all?
Representative Witt said no, it wouldn't matter where the corporation is incorporated, as long as it's has economic, the consolidated group has economic activity in Oregon. Therefore, we will look at their water's edge sales and their national income and apportion a share of that back to the U.S. or back to Oregon.
Based on Oregon sales.
Right. So it doesn't matter where they're incorporated. That doesn't affect we. Most of the revenue that we receive in the corporate income tax comes through apportioned income from companies or corporations that operate in more than one state.
Now, Representative Vega Peterson.
Okay, thank you, Chair. So this is kind of a building on Representative Davis's question. I just want to make sure, because I don't think it would be double counted, but I want to check with Paul to make sure that my thinking is correct, that no matter what other states are doing in terms of countries that meet the criteria for our bill, we would hope that all those states that have done things like Oregon has done has roughly the same total amount, being the water's edge plus whatever else is comes up with the income that's reported in the listed jurisdictions. But we wouldn't be double counting it here in Oregon because we're only looking at the Oregon the income apportioned to Oregon, right? So hopefully everybody has the same kind of denominator that we're working with. But in terms of actually figuring out how much they owe here in Oregon, we're not counting what their other states are charging them. We're just looking at what's the apportioned to Oregon piece.
Yes, okay. That's exactly right. Now, mm-hmm. And from at a national level, you can deduct your state and local taxes on your corporate return, but your Oregon return, you can't deduct your federal taxes.
All right, now we're down to consolidated return C.
Consolidated return C. Now this is the example we think that would be more reflective of the kind of a mixed country and the two. I think they would probably fit this most from the recommended additional list in the dash six are Switzerland and the Netherlands, where you have economic activity. And we've tried to account for that in this example by $5 billion worth of sales by this corporation in the listed jurisdiction. So as you recall from earlier, the effect of that is that while the Oregon is capturing some income that is not captured, that was not captured before this law became in effect, you're not capturing as much of it because you're diluting the sales factor by adding this additional $5 billion of sales to the total sales. Oregon sales don't change because of this. So now you've got a fixed level of Oregon sales, and you're dividing it by a bigger number, and you come up with a smaller apportionment factor. In my example, the Oregon's sales share, the apportionment factor, goes from 5% to about 4.8%. And, of course, with large amount of income, that could be significant. So, and also this same consolidated return has profit shifting going on among from other jurisdictions. They're not attributable to the U.S. activities. So we pulled that 500 out, and now the result, instead of having the $300 million in income apportioned back to Oregon, or the $275 we did in case B, we're down to $261 because we've diluted the sales factor with the sales in the listed jurisdiction, and we've also subtracted out the profit shifting that couldn't be attributed back to the U.S. Mm-hmm. So the net result is you still have a higher tax burden than you did in the days before the 2013 legislation, but the effect is an increase of $900,000 instead of the higher numbers you get in the other cases. So that's the intent of the language in the Dash 6 amendment, is to make sure that non-attributable portion comes out, or the corporation is allowed to take eliminate that from being portioned back to Oregon.
Now let me ask a question. I'm looking at this last example. I noticed the ratio between Oregon sales and Total Water's Edge sales that you have is at 5%. The ratio between income attributable to the United States and sales in the listed jurisdiction under that red list stuff, the other $500 million that's not actually listed there. When you look at those ratios, it's actually $1 in 10 is the ratio. And so in that situation, this kind of accounting will always lead to a slightly larger Oregon tax, won't it? Where the where the profit is a larger percentage of the listed jurisdiction sales than the profit is of the Water's Edge total sales.
Yes, Mr. Chair, I think there's two things there. One is that, yes, we would suspect that by the criteria we're using, we would not have a jurisdiction on that list mm-hmm. that did not lead to some increase. And that's because we think they meet the criteria of a destination for profit shifting. Right. So you suspect that to always be a positive number. Now, it certainly would not be the case for the jurisdictions that don't meet that criteria. You could well have a dilution of your sales factor enough to offset the additional income. And in fact, I think we had an example when we first looked at this. If the ratio is the same as the U.S. ratio in terms of net income and total sales, then there would be no effect on the taxpayer's net liability. So that's the key, is the sales ratio to net income. And what we're assuming and by this measure is if you have a high ratio, then there's some profit shifting going on to that jurisdiction.
Right, and if the ratio is the same, you'd make a different assumption.
If the ratio is the same, then we would assume there's not profit shifting.
Right.
I mean, that would be the implication.
Hmm. Right.
It's measure, but it would be a pretty good indication.
It's a pretty close measure. Representative Davis.
Thank you, Chair. I'm just looking at this like a fifth grader.
I find myself in that spot a lot.
No, I think you're in college and your discussion you're just having. No. I'm not there yet.
I will add, Mr. Chair, back on the broader question about the data we have on U.S. affiliates. When we take the ratio of sales to net income for large U.S. corporations based on their U.S. Tax returns, that ratio of net income to sales is about 6.5%. These would be corporations over $2 trillion in assets. So those are big corporations. About 6.5%. When I take the data for the foreign affiliates and look at their sales, this would be the total sales, and then look at their net income reported, it's about 16.5%. So that's suggestive that there's probably an overall return that's a combination of those two, and the difference is made up through profit shifting. that's a rough measure, but it's an indication.
Mr. Chair, mm-hmm. So the in consolidated return C, sales enlisted jurisdiction, is that's added to Water's Edge total sales for purposes of this calculation?
Yes.
So we get to a bill, 100 million.
Yes.
That's the first step. So we are adding to adding to United States sales that which we know is sales overseas.
That's right. So, and so now the Oregon sales number is what determines the apportionment factor.
Yeah, and that doesn't
change. The Oregon sales number is 4750. So you're taking 4750 and dividing that into 100. So that's where you get the 4.8 instead of 4750 into 9500 gives you the 5%.
Okay, but we're still taking sales that we know are reported not in the United States and adding them to a United States return?
Yeah.
But isn't that what we're trying to avoid, is taking activity we know is actually happening elsewhere and adding it back to our return?
But if you do the arithmetic, what the effect of that is to lower the Oregon ratio of the total. Because we're not changing the Oregon number, we're changing the denominator, not the numerator.
Yeah. Yeah,
and so adding in sales that are made in other places to the denominator will actually reduce the portion of that that is attributable to Oregon, and the effect of that arithmetically is what he's demonstrated here. It reduces the taxes by another $1 million lower than in example B, where the other facts are exactly the same.
If I may add, Representative Davis, the way I've thought of this is that what we're really doing in this case is we're treating one of these listed jurisdictions as if it were another state, if it were the 51st state. So what we're saying is, okay, we're not accounting for it with the current Water's Edge, but if we include this 51st state, we can include their income. But not only can we include their income, we have to include their sales, because now we're saying our sales is a percentage of a bigger total.
And the arithmetic effect of that is to exclude the income attributable to their sales from our taxation. That's the point. That's why you do it, not because you're trying to rope them into the United States somehow, but it's an arithmetical way of excluding the sales made in that country from the calculation from which you derive Oregon sales.
And that's what we consider in terms of our laws regarding apportionment. We're saying that's the measure of economic activity that we use is sales. We're saying that's the best measure to apportion corporate income, corporate net income among the different states to us. So if we didn't account for that, we'd be overtaxing this this source.
Exactly.
Just a comment. I'm still, maybe I'm in sixth grade now, still having trouble with the concept of sales that we now know are actually occurring in the 51st state still being added to a United States return at this point. Because that's the opposite of the intent, I thought, with the tax haven legislation originally and what we want to do here.
Well,
when we know there's actual economic activity happening overseas.
The point of the modifications that we're doing is to make certain that we don't tax income which is honestly attributable to a different country. The first change is the one where they simply tell us this income stream comes from this other place, not from the United States. That's B. C is we had sales in that country. Some of that income that we make is attributable to sales in that country. So this arithmetical method is a way of accounting for the sales in the other country upon which they do not pay Oregon taxes. So it's a way of excluding an amount from Oregon. Remember, the ratio that we have in the United States is a way of excluding the income made in other states from Oregon's taxable income. This simply means, well, we're going to add the income from this other country to that denominator, so we also exclude that from taxing in Oregon, just like we do the income made in other states. So it's a way of excluding, not adding.
Maybe I'm halfway through sixth grade now.
So you're essentially canceling them out.
I mean,
you're diluting it and then canceling them, and then that takes a percentage down, if that makes any more sense.
You're using a smaller percentage to attribute back to Oregon. And, I mean, if you look at the bottom line numbers, the numbers in red, the change in the Oregon tax, the only change between consolidated return B and consolidated return C is the fact that you have sales in the listed jurisdiction in the C example, and that takes $1 million off your tax bill.
Now, the, another example that you might give us that you haven't given us yet, which we'll call D for the moment, would be a business where the primary business activity is in one of the listed countries, and the business activity in the United States and in Oregon is a minor part of their action, of their activity. And so most of their income is in, most of their profits are probably attributable to that other country. If you could do the calculation for that country, for that company, I think it makes it clear why we're not after the Netherlands beer companies, for example, one of the ones that I've heard about. I don't expect that today, but you know, if we have further conversation about this bill, that would be a useful exercise. Representative Davis.
Thank you, Chair, and I think I'm clarifying some of my own troubling faces that I'm making. I mean, if I recall why we passed tax haven legislation, it is essentially to bring into the United States those jurisdictions which truly do not have any bona fide economic activity going on.
That was stage one.
Stage one, the pure. As I see this proposal, we are attempting to add jurisdictions, because the first step still is to list jurisdictions. But there's an acknowledgement in B and C, in my mind, that there is legitimate activity taking place in those jurisdictions. And this is a mighty slippery road that we start to go down when we say, we think your guys are, that you, Netherlands, are 15% legitimate. We'll still apportion from you. We'll make you the 51st state. We have to recognize now that you guys have headquarters and sales and employees, so we'll dilute in a manner that I don't fully understand yet the effect. But to me, it's a interesting progression that we may be going down.
Right. And, you know, I wouldn't be feeling as strongly as I do about a couple of European countries, one of which you've named, if it weren't for the fact that the statistical data that we do have shows that the vast majority of the financial flows are related to exactly this kind of financial activity, not on the part of the country. I'm not criticizing the country at all. On the part of the businesses...
They disagree.
On the part of the businesses that use these mechanisms that that they have available to them. And I was startled by the numbers when we realized that 80% of, I think the number was $700 billion a year that flows into the Netherlands, it flows into holding companies. 80%, that's a pretty big number. And so I think that's part of why the department included them on the list in their report, and why it's important for us to, as we do our stepwise improvement on the enhanced reporting law, make this improvement next. Now, there may be other improvements we need to make in future years. You know, you heard the testimony the other day on the natural resources estate tax, how it took us 6 years and we made another fix this year on ranch property in two states. I expect that this isn't going to go away. It's going to keep coming up, but we'll get closer and closer to what works over time. Unless, of course, the Internal Revenue Service and the Congress of the United States gets its act together and fixes the Internal Revenue Code so that the initial report we get based on the data that they report to the feds, accurately reflects U.S. income, which it doesn't do now.
Representative Whitson. Consolidated return B, was that the dash fours, and then consolidated return C, is that reflective of the dash sixes?
Representative Whitson, no, the dash fours were the policies in the dash four were the same. We just made some wording changes. There was several of the individual jurisdictions that should have been dropped out were not. And we did make a slight change to the wording for the non-U.S. activity. So, but other than that, the policy was pretty much the same in four and six. Six was a cleanup of four. We did change the starting date till 2016.
I had one other question. What is different about Singapore and Dubai that they're not on this list, since they're major world banking centers?
Representative Whitson, I think the short answer is that we, based on the Department of Revenue's report, and they did go back and review the initial list, as we've talked about, was the list that Montana had. So we borrowed the Montana list. But we also asked the department to make a report and come back, and they, the items, the jurisdictions that were listed in the Montana report in our 13 statute, they confirmed should be, and then recommended these additional jurisdictions. But they all meet the criteria of Section 4, which is in the Dash 6 amendment, starting on page 4. Those are the criteria that came from the Multi-State Tax Commission. That's what they recommended verbatim, and that's what Department of Revenue used in their report to do their analysis and determine, do these jurisdictions meet this criteria?
Is there anything else on this one today? If not, we'll close the work session on House Bill 2099. Paul, do we have the dash 3 on 2818? I didn't see it in OLIS, and it may just be I'm looking in the wrong place.
We have a dash 1, Mr. Chair.
Dash 1?
Yes.
I'm sorry, I misunderstood.
2818, we have the dash 1, and Christine can talk about that.
So we'll open the work session on House Bill 2818. If we end up being ready on this one, this is one that I would expect to work today, but I haven't read the dash 1 yet, so which I need to do, so I don't know.
Mr. Chair, members of the committee, the House Bill 2818, you have the dash 1 there in OLIS. What the dash 1 would do is create a task force on charitable checkoffs. And when it consists of 5 members as follows, 2 members of the Senate and 3 members of the House of Representatives. There is both a fiscal impact light statement, but they express that there could be a would likely be a fiscal impact having to do with staffing the task force. And there is a revenue light in the OLIS as well.
Okay. All right. So this would take this bill to the Ways and Means Committee.
Mm-hmm.
All right.
Mr. Chair?
Yes, Representative Davis.
Is this a gut stuff?
I think so.
Or does this leave the original edition of the firefighter?
Oh, you're right. You're correct. It's an add-on after line 11. I think the idea is that this this would get the conversation in this task force of the whole concept of the charitable checkoff and how it operates.
Mm-hmm.
I think that's right.
Representative
Vega Peterson.
Chair, I move the dash 1 amendment to
House Bill 2818.
Thank you. House Bill 2818.
Thank you. Representative Vega Peterson moves the dash 1 amendment to House Bill 2818. Is there further discussion?
Mr. Chair.
Yes, Representative Davis.
I'm going to vote against this. I don't think it's a wise use of so many members of the legislature's resources at this time. Thank you.
Okay. Others? Other comments? Representative Vega Peterson.
I would just say I think that you know, I think Representative Boone had said that it took her several sessions, legislative sessions, to actually, you know, get the bill moving this forward in the process. And so I think that the opportunity to have a discussion about how the process is and if there's ways that can be improved is a good thing. So I'll be supporting the amendment.
Great. Thank you very much. Representative Vega Peterson, I would request, if you don't mind, removing retracting your motion for the time being. I'd like to work the bill when we have more members here.
I just had a comment.
Please.
Okay. So it's essentially a task force.
It contains the original bill,
right,
and then adds this task force to it.
Did we discuss the task force?
We did not.
Just recess and see if we can.
This is the first we've heard about it.
Can we just recess and
see? Can we recess?
Yeah.
Can we stand at ease?
All right, we'll stand at ease. Don't go away. Committee will come back to order. Before we go any further, I'll simply note that Representative Boone has been consulted about this amendment and has approved it. But I think, given under the circumstances, I'd renew my request for Representative Vega Peterson to withdraw a motion and allow me to move this at a later time.
Chair, I withdraw the motion to move the amendment.
Thank you. And with that, we'll close the work session on House Bill 2818. Let's see. The other one that we want to open for talk today is House Bill 2077. I think we have a new amendment. So we'll open the work session on House Bill 2077.
Okay, Mr. Chair, members of the committee, the new amendment is the -5 amendment, which is it is the -3 amendment, but cleaned up. There were a number of, I guess, drafting errors might be the way to describe it.
All right.
But the policy, there is no policy change between the -5 and the -3. Within here, you do have all of the paperwork for the -5. But then if I can move to the -4, which was shared yesterday, there is some question, just to refresh the committee's memory, in the -4.
Like 18 and 19 on page 2?
Page 2, yes.
Yeah.
It references additional information to be included on the report, and specifically it identifies any other taxes paid to the state or local government by the taxpayer, such as property taxes and payroll taxes. We do have some input in OLIS from the Department of Revenue that describes some of the complexities and problems with gathering that information. The -3 and the -5, kind of in comparison, were put together with trying to craft a policy that would have a minimal fiscal impact. The potential for the lines 18 and 19, while we do not have an official fiscal impact for this amendment, could raise a number of problems and collecting a lot of information. It's information that, what it boils down to is, it's not information directly available to the Department of Revenue or on the tax return, so it would require a different kind of effort.
Gotcha. Representative Davis.
Mr. Chair, I'd like to move the -4 amendment to House Bill 2077.
Okay. Representative Davis moves the -4 amendment to House Bill 2077. That 1, 2, 3, 4, 5. We do have a quorum. Is there any objection to the amendment? We'll let you know that I object to it. Representative Vega Peterson?
I haven't had a chance to look at the amendment yet, okay, so I'd appreciate the opportunity to do that.
Same.
I'm sorry?
I agree with what Representative Vega Peterson said.
Okay. Want to take a moment to review it? I'll simply note while you're reviewing it that
I have also, unfortunately, many clever ideas, which I like a lot, which turn out not to be workable. I like this idea, but unfortunately, with the cost of doing it, it would require that the bill go to Ways and Means. Ways and Means is short of funds, makes it really difficult to work this kind of a bill.
Mr. Chair?
I'm waiting for the two members who asked for time. This is identical to the dash 5, is it, except for those lines?
There are some drafting differences between the dash 4 and the dash 5, some wording changes. With the dash 3 to the dash 4 to the dash 5, there was kind of a leapfrogging in the refinement of some of the text.
Okay.
I think the intent, and I can point out a couple of those. I think the bottom line, though, is the policy intent is the same except for these two lines.
Okay.
Okay.
Yes.
May we stand at ease for a couple moments?
Sure. The committee will stand at ease. Don't wander off. The committee will come back to order. The motion on the floor is the motion to adopt the dash 4 amendment to this bill, which is House Bill 2077. I think we better call the roll.
All right. Can we get a little, I think there was a comment.
Did somebody else have another comment before we vote?
Yeah.
I mean, Mr. Chair, I think with your discretion, it would be great to understand, I guess, the intent of the policy we're trying to pass. What is it we're trying to accomplish here that's going to be beneficial for our state and for our revenue-generating companies in the state of Oregon? So what is it we're trying to accomplish with either any of the amendments and the base bill?
Yeah, of course, we've talked about the intent for a long time. Right now we're dealing with practicalities of how big a bite you can chew, bite off in one bill, and how much of a fiscal impact you're willing to incur. And my comment was, I really like lines 18 and 19, that the essential add-on, but it's a bigger bite, and it adds a fiscal. So that's why I'm opposed to the motion.
Follow-up.
Yeah, please.
Yes.
Yeah.
In addition to that, though, or in a more broad sense, what's the intent of the disclosure that we're going to require of these industries or these entities? What are we trying to accomplish that's going to be beneficial, again, for the state?
Well, others may have a different thought, but from my point of view, the point of it is to increase transparency and make it easier for this committee and other people working on tax policy in Oregon to understand both the benefits and the disadvantages of the current tax policy, and perhaps work on tax policies that would be fairer and more appropriate for Oregon, if there are any such. This may, of course, the policy we have now may, of course, be the very best possible policy in the world, which I doubt, but it's possible, and if that's the case, information like this would help to demonstrate that.
Are there other parallels in other states where they are enacting policies similar to this? We worry about other states requiring this sort of disclosure.
Do we know about that, Chris?
I don't know exactly. I think there's some other states that do some sort of cyber shame kind of thing where they list some information on the website, but I don't know the detail about what other states may or may not disclose.
Oregon is not unique in considering this kind of bill.
No, the notion of considering it is there, and the disclosure laws are ubiquitous.
Okay.
The debate definitely exists elsewhere.
All right. Are you ready to vote? Let's call the roll, and the motion is on the dash 4 amendment.
Representative Davis.
Yes.
Representative Johnson.
No.
Representative Leiniger.
No.
Representative Reed.
Excused.
Representative Smith-Warner.
Excused.
Representative Whitson.
Yes.
Vice Chair Megan Peterson?
No.
Representative Chair Barnhart?
No. And Representative Benz is excused.
The motion, having failed to get the required majority, is not adopted. And with that, we'll close the work session on House Bill 2077. Colleagues, I think that concludes the business we have for today.
Chair,
with a couple of notes that we need to work on the record for carrying over. Representative Vega Peterson, did you have?
Yes, can we stand at ease for 1 second?
Mm-hmm. Sure.
Okay. Maybe more than a second, but
we'll stand at ease. Please don't want. When you're ready. All right. So it turns out we do have another piece of business to do. We'll reopen the work session on House Bill 2818. Representative Vega Peterson has a motion, I believe.
Yes. Chair Barnhart, I would like to move the -1 amendment to House Bill 2818.
Thank you. Representative Vega Peterson moves the -1 amendment to House Bill 2818. I would simply note by way of discussion that Representative Boone has approved this amendment. It adds to the bill a task force to study the whole concept of the charitable checkoff with members from the House and the Senate to do it, and requires a subsequent referral to the Committee on Ways and Means. Representative Davis.
Thank you, Mr. Chair. I'm still object to the addition of the task force. I strongly support the underlying bill. It's had a lot of sessions to get going. I think it's ready to rock. I also have concerns with utilizing a task force. I am very concerned that a task force might cost more than the actual checkoffs that this organization might individually receive. In addition to the time, effort, and resources, I'm also very concerned with the structure of the task force. As far as I read it, it's only legislators. Is that, mm-hmm. is that correct? Or are there other stakeholders who might be involved?
Two members
from the Senate.
Three from the House.
Three from the House.
Well, at least we got that part right.
That's it.
And staffed by the commission.
But there's no other...
Staffed by the commission.
There's no other stakeholders. There's no other groups who may be interested in charitable checkoffs. To me, it's not an appropriate use of legislators' time, especially without other groups involved.
Other discussion?
They'll provide staff support, but there's no membership.
I have a question.
Representative Whitson?
I was wondering why we are having a task force when the underlying bill, I guess I'm not understanding the purpose of the task force when the underlying bill seems to be everybody's willing to go along with that. Why we added that, or someone added that onto it today?
Well, I'm looking at the amendment.
I guess I'd like to ask. Would the bill be in effect without the task force? What is the purpose of the task force? If we pass the bill, why?
Well, the point of the task force, of course, would be to study the whole issue of the charitable checkoff and how it works. They shall investigate the functioning, and I'm reading from the Section 3, Sub 2, Line 8 on the first page of the amendment. The task force shall investigate the functioning of the charitable checkoff system and what steps may be taken to improve functioning of the charitable checkoff system. That's the language in the bill. That's what I thought it was likely to be before I actually found that piece. I can tell you my understanding is it has been approved by Representative Boone, and that this is a method by which we can deal with a perennial issue, which is the legislature writing exceptions to the statute that otherwise governs the manner in which charities are added to the charitable checkoff list. And that's the point of it, I think. Representative Leininger?
Thank you. I feel like Representative Boone has worked hard on this. It's a really good cause. It's an important cause. This task force, based on the testimony that I heard, it is reasonable to have an assessment of how exactly we're operating this, and I support adopting the amendment. And I would really like to see us move this forward.
Thank you. Other discussion?
Mr. Chair.
Yes, Representative
Davis. And I very much apologize. Could we just have a brief recess?
Yes, certainly.
Thank you.
I will note we have 17 minutes left in our time. Now hopefully it'll be...
Take as long as you need.
Okay. 16. Promise. No longer than 16.
All right. Minutes, thank you. The committee will stand at ease.
I got to get 10,000 steps.
Committee will come back to order. Please call the roll. The motion is on the adoption of the -1 amendment.
Representative Davis.
No.
Representative Johnson.
No.
Representative Leiner.
Aye.
Representative Reed.
Aye.
Representative Smith-Warner.
Aye.
Representative Whitson.
No.
Vice Chair Vega-Peterson.
Aye.
Chair Barnhart.
Aye. Representative Vance is excused. Motion having required majority is adopted. Representative Vega-Peterson.
Chair, I move House Bill 2818 as amended to the floor with a due pass recommendation with a ask for a referral to Ways and Means.
Thank you. Representative Vega-Peterson moves House Bill 2818 as amended to the floor with a due pass recommendation and that a subsequent referral to the Joint Committee on Ways and Means be added by the Speaker. Any additional discussion? Please call the roll.
Representative Davis.
No.
Representative Johnson.
Aye.
Representative Leidinger.
Aye.
Representative Reed.
Aye.
Representative Smith-Warner.
Aye.
Representative Whitson.
No.
Vice Chair Megan Peterson.
Aye.
Chair Barnhart.
Aye. Representative Bence is excused. The motion having received the required majority is adopted. The bill goes to Ways and Means. Close the work session on House Bill 2818. Colleagues, just to make certain, we have passed out Senate Bill 26. House Bill 2125 is over to Tuesday. House Bill 2961 will be rescheduled. House Bill 2099 is over to Tuesday. House Bill 2077 is over to Tuesday. House Bill 3246 is over to Tuesday. House Bill 2449 is over to Tuesday. And House Bill 2075 is over to Tuesday. Paul, have I missed anything? I have not. With that, the committee is adjourned.